The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. In case you hadn't heard, Brendan Slocum's debut novel, The Violin Conspiracy, was just named the Good Morning America Book Club selection for February. A review in the New York Times calls the book a page-turner and musical bildungsroman cleverly contained within a literary thriller. The novel follows a black musician named Ray McMillan as he confronts the injustices of racism in the profession of classical music and the theft of his great-grandfather's priceless Stradivarius violin. Brendan Slocum knows of what he writes. A public and private school music educator for more than 20 years, he has performed on violin with the Washington Metropolitan Symphony, Prince George's Philharmonic, and has frequently served as a guest conductor for orchestras throughout Virginia and North Carolina. He is also the founder of the Philippines-based nonprofit organization, Hands Across the Sea, which has the mission to provide instruments, lessons, and financial support to young music students. Tonight, Brendan will be in conversation with Stanford Thompson, professional trumpeter and founder and executive director of Play On Philly. Play On Philly provides to students who would typically lack access high-quality music education as a vehicle for life skills and academic achievement. Stanford was recently named a Mid-Atlantic Arts Foundation 2021 Alan Cooper Leadership in the Arts honoree, and we are pleased to have him back. Please join me in welcoming Brendan Slocum and Stanford Thompson to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Thank you, Andy, and a big thanks to the Free Library of Philadelphia for having us here and hosting this event, and especially to our online audience that is tuning in live and those that will hear this later. Really great to have you all participate with us here in Philadelphia. I also want to thank Brendan for the book, Vintage Books and Anchor Books of Penguin Random House, for their support throughout this whole project. And you know, we talked just for a couple of minutes backstage, and one of my first things was, you know, this was a pretty emotional read for me. There were several moments getting through this book where I had to take a moment, although I was able to consume this very, very quickly. And I loved a lot of the imagery that you have throughout the book. And while not being a trained violinist or a trained string player, you really helped me kind of relive a lot of moments, thinking about rehearsals, thinking about gigs, thinking about the practicing, the things you tell yourself, you know, getting on another plane, another train, you know, opening up that case despite what's going on in the background or your personal life, and just being really, really focused. And it was just really cool to relive a lot of that. And I couldn't also help but to think of, you know, the main character in the book, his name is Ray. And I actually have a really good friend named Ray, Ray Chen, who owns a Strad. And probably 5 or 6 years ago, Ray performed with our students at Play On Philly. And if I would have just thought about it, I could have stolen that violin and put up some ransom for it. It's a $10 million Strad. So anyway, I just couldn't help but to think about halfway through this, I was like, yeah, I think I really could have gotten away with this, because Ray in this book is not going to find the person. Some donor is going to come in and pay the ransom so that he can get the violin back and do the Tchaikovsky competition. So anyway, it was just a really, really enjoyable experience. At times, kind of a painful experience for myself, but really interesting to see how Ray kind of develops in the book, and of course, everything that you learn about Ray and his background. So, I mean, first I want to, you know, just kind of ask a couple of big questions, and for those that are in the audience, there'll be an opportunity at the end to ask some questions, so hope that that you'll also participate later on in this. But this is your first book.
Yes.
I would describe this as a mystery, a thriller, about a rising black professional classical violinist. Their prized possession, this Stradivarius violin that's worth $10 million, being held for ransom weeks before this, the biggest competition that could really set this violinist up for, you know, the biggest career. And, you know, I was kind of thinking, and what I kind of struggled a little bit with, okay? Like, imagine if someone gave you a house. And imagine if that house just happened to be worth $10 million, okay? I would sell the house, because for a tenth of that, I could get a really great place across the street here from the library, and I'd still have $9 million left over. So I was struggling a little bit to say, he should have sold this $10 million violin. You can get you a pretty good one for $250,000. Okay, never mind. You're not following that? No.
I totally get
okay,
it.
All right.
You're not the first person that's
okay.
said that.
But I do want to ask you, I mean, what really inspired you to pull out the pen to write this? And if you can kind of talk about the journey that you went through from the moment you pulled out that pen to when, you know, publication date hit just 2 days ago on February 1st. If you can just kind of take us through this experience writing your first book.
Wow. Okay. First, I am super jealous that you know Ray Chen, and we're going to talk about some okay. autograph and oh, picture okay. or something. All right. Yeah. Just tell him it was after I named it after him.
Okay,
just,
I will.
That's, right. that should do it. wow. I started writing this book in July of, actually July 28th of 2020. The pandemic was raging, and I was doing the same thing everyone else was doing, sitting in the house, eating, getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And I decided to start exercising, going out and running every day. Terrified, of course, that I was going to catch the Rona. And it was, you know, I wasn't teaching anymore because I would teach lessons. I would go to my students' homes and teach them lessons, and everything stopped. Everything stopped. I saw an advertisement for selling books in the age of COVID. All right, you know, I wrote a book a long time ago, which was terrible. I love it, but it's a great story, but my writing was not that good. It was 20 years ago that I'd written this manuscript. So it's like, I'll give it another shot. I wrote something. I sent it off to an agent. They said, wow, this is terrible, but you have a good voice, so you should try writing something that you know. My first one was science fiction. So I'm going to get back to it at one point. And so, okay, yeah, Brendan, you can do your science fiction thing. I just started writing what I knew, which was music. And, you know, I basically wanted to tell my own story. Years and years and years ago, probably 30 years ago, one of my friends said, Brendan, you should write a story about your life. You have just done some interesting things. There's just so much stuff that's gone on with you in such a short amount of time. You should do that. I didn't think anything of it. But it's like, you know, well, why not? Some interesting things have happened to me, and I'm a musician and I know about music, so I'll give it a shot. And Violin Conspiracy, just it was easy to do because these stories have been in my head for so long. And with the events of 2020, George Floyd and everything, I just felt that the time was right to get these types of stories out. Previously, when I would tell stories like this, people would say, no, you're just exaggerating. No, that's not happening. No, you're just, that's not real. Your perception is off. You're wrong. And, you know, you can't fight people. Your perception is your perception, and their perception is their perception. And neither one is right or wrong. They're just different. And my perspective was, these things happen. So I put it down on paper, and as I was writing, everything came really easily. And I would write 2,500 words a day. I sit down for 3 hours and write every day. My agent, who is phenomenal, would edit on the fly with me and give me some suggestions and ideas, and we would argue. He would say, take this out because that doesn't happen. And I'd say, yes, it does happen because it happened to me. And it was a fight, and fortunately I won, and it made it into the book. And we just kind of go along, and in 2 months I had it done. And I was blessed in late December with a call saying, would you accept this offer for a 2-book deal? Yes, I will. Happily.
Right. And I mean, you've been a lot of places talking about this book and many other stops coming up.
Yeah.
Yeah. And glad that Philadelphia will be the best stop that you have.
Absolutely. Look at this. You guys, can I give you some applause for coming out tonight? You guys are awesome. Thank you.
So, I mean, so in the book, and I don't want to give this book away. It's really, really tough. I really want to tell people what happened. Has anybody been able to get through the book yet that's in the room? Oh, okay. Well, I got a phone call today from someone who got through the book all day yesterday and wanted to talk with me about it. But you do a really, really good job of giving enough information.
My sincerest apologies. Okay. Don't know what that was about. Sorry.
So in the book, you do a really great job of giving enough information that makes everybody around Ray look guilty for stealing the violin.
Right.
And I had a tough time. I first thought I knew who it was at the very beginning. That changed at least twice. And then when you find out what really happens, it's like, oh, yeah. In some ways, you should have saw it coming, but you didn't see it coming. You know, you got hit by that bus. And everything, you got to read it to figure out what it is. But you know, again, it was still a nice ride and really kind of challenging to figure out the riddle. Mm-hmm. And I will say, like, before it was revealed, I got to a point where I'm like, okay, I'm going to stop trying to figure out who did it. But on the same side, I also really like kind of the musical and the personal journey that Ray was on throughout the book, and especially how the relationships of the people around him kind of modulated.
Right.
So when I think about kind of the modulations in this book, I think about things of watching Ray go from, you know, his first wedding gig to some of the best concert venues. And in that, you are going to experience some of the joys of that first experience playing the wedding and some really not great things that happen.
Yeah.
And same thing of playing in some of the best concert halls. And what I remember in the book is the joy Ray had when Ray had the violin under his chin, making music with other people. I think about the modulation of like having a crappy school violin to a Strat. I mean, that's a really big change. Hardly anybody in the world gets their hands on such a great instrument. I also think about the violin being like really, really annoying to Ray's mom, to then learning a little bit later what was behind a lot of it, and it probably had very little to do with, you know, scratching away until it started to sound better, but more of learning how that violin came about. Mm-hmm. And again, what I just said about that $10 million house, I think Ray's mom and a lot of other people had an idea of, you know, we could really, you know, sell that instrument and be okay.
Yeah.
And then I think about the modulation of a youth completely kind of historically divested of the types of an educational experience that I believe every young person should have. Mm-hmm. And every young person should have the ability to make beautiful art and pursue it at the level and take it as far as they can. But the modulation of this divested kid who had something special and how that kid was transformed into, you know, somebody with a worldwide reputation, being sought after, you know, being paid well, having these experiences that, you know, really kind of, you know, shaped his life. Mm-hmm. And then I also think about what we call repeats in music. Sometimes when a composer really likes what they wrote, they'll just put a repeat symbol, you go back and do it again. I usually don't like those. But kind of figuratively speaking, kind of the repeats and the reflections of Ray. Things like the prejudice, the racism, the hate, the barriers put in front of Ray. But on the positive side, things like really good mentors, support that would just kind of come out of nowhere. The phone call, the buddy that would say, hey, come join me for this gig, that type of thing. And then also the empathy. Mm-hmm. I think about the empathy and the love from Ray's grandmother throughout this. And then kind of the last thing is this part about Ray's inner drive and his resilience, his confidence, his love for the music, that just as you learn more about Ray and Ray's experiences, these things just repeat inside of him over and over and over again, and that really keeps him going. So in kind of, thinking about these modulations and thinking about these repeats of the character of Ray in this book, can you talk some about those dynamics that Ray faces in the novel and then how that relates to your own personal experiences?
Absolutely. If you haven't read the book yet, or first you're in for a treat, if I do say so myself. Ray is a normal, everyday kid. He just happens to have a love for music, and he loves it. It is a part of him. And not everyone understands it. Not everybody gets that, and that's okay. He is confronted with a lot of pressure to go get a job. You don't need to do this. You're never going to make this work. You won't be successful. I'm trying to help you because this is not for you. And that's a constant message being drilled into his head. It's not for you. You can't do it. But along those same lines, as you mentioned, was he gets one or two mentors and a lot of support. And just the fact that it repeats itself over and over and over again, that is one of those things that really came from my experience. As a kid, I just fell in love with classical music the first time I heard a piece. And the first piece I ever heard classical was Mozart Symphony No. 40. You all know it. I promise you all know it. First time I heard that, what is this? This is the greatest thing I've ever heard. What is this? And my music teacher saw that I was really excited about it. And they would, kind of push me towards this. Well, what about this? Well, what about this? Well, I want more. Give me more. I'm eager for this. And I just loved it. And the fact that someone saw that it was doing something for me and to me. Well, here's this black kid and the sea of white faces who I've never had a kid like this before. And this kid, I've never seen someone who is this into it, not someone who looked like you who was this much into it. There must be something there. So let's nourish it. Let's enhance it. And going along, I was fortunate enough to have a couple of teachers that saw something. When Ray was learning to play his violin, his teachers, they really didn't give two, flying figs about whether or not he was good. He just went along. He was just another face in the crowd. His grandmother knew that he loved it, and he had the best relationship with his grandma Nora in the book, and he absolutely loved her, and she absolutely loved him, and she saw in him that she saw this love for music in him, and she did everything she could to encourage and enhance it within him. And in doing that, he learned from her to actually believe in himself. He got most of his confidence from her. He's like, okay, I can play this, and I'm going to play this, and I'm going to go tell my grandma that I played this, and I played it well. When the wedding comes up, and he's playing for the first time at a wedding, he gets a couple of $100 for it. And for a kid, a teenager, to make a couple of $100 just playing an instrument, I know you know how this is. That is the highlight. That is one of the highlights that you will never forget. My first wedding that I played, I was in seventh grade. You couldn't tell me anything. I got $25 for it. I thought I had just made it. I am a pro now. I'm a professional. I played for the first time for money. Yeah, you can hire me if you want. And just the experience that Ray had, it wasn't about the money. It was about the love of doing what he loved to do, and he could do it. And this was, I get an opportunity to do this. How many times am I going to be able to do this? This is the first of many. He was looking, way, way, way ahead. head. And just the support that he had from his friends and from his grandmother, that kept him going. That was very sustaining for him. And you will see in the book that these themes do come back around every time he gets up and something happens that is just wonderful. Something comes that's twice as bad and just squashes him. And you would think that, all right, that would be enough to make me want to quit. That would be enough. But his resilience is a result of the people that supported him throughout his journey. Yeah.
So, you know, kind of thinking a little bit about, you know, that support. I mean, some of those voices like, you know, grandma in the book. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming there's a grandmother in your life, or maybe was in your life, that provided that type of support. Can you just talk a little bit about that figure in your life, or what the, you know, sure, who the equivalent?
Sure. I had a couple of people. Grandma Nora in the book is actually modeled after my own grandma, okay, whose name was Nora. Yeah. And when I tell you, she was the sweetest woman in the world, just loving towards all of her children, all of her grandchildren. She's about 5 feet tall. I don't want to offend anybody, but her hair was blue. She would put that blue stuff in her hair. Does anyone know what that stuff is? And I could never figure it out. So, Grandma, why is your hair blue?
Yeah.
Oh, honey, it
yeah.
just is. Okay, well. And she was, you know, this tall, and she had the sweetest voice you have ever heard in your life. And she talked slow and soft, and she was just so loving. It's like, okay, Grandma, you're making, I'm getting diabetes listening to you because you're so sweet. I think that's one of the lines in the book. And she was just, I mean, you couldn't help but love her. And she always showed her love. And one of my college teacher was my mentor. That is the equivalent of Dr. Janice Stevens in the book. And when I tell you, I owe this woman everything. Not only did she teach me how to play the violin, she taught me how to teach. She taught me confidence. She showed me that there was a confidence in me that I never would have thought existed. You know, there was a moment in the book as well, and this is from my own life, that I was doing a performance on stage on a convocation in front of the music student body, and I was playing the Kabalevsky violin concerto, and I just knew I was going to rock it, and I missed a high F, and I was done. I can't believe I did this. I wanted to walk off stage right in the middle of the piece, but I knew I had to finish, and I was devastated. I was going to quit. I packed up my stuff, and I left, and I was going to quit. My teacher called me and said, Brendan, it's okay. It happens. You know, she was honest. No, it wasn't the best performance, which I knew it was, but she didn't rub it in. She wasn't furious at me or anything. She got it. She totally knew that this is one of those stepping stones that you had to go through. It happens to everybody. A bad performance. It was horrible. And I really wanted to quit. She encouraged me to keep going. And my very next performance, when I tell you, I destroyed it. People are talking about that performance to this day. It was that good. I actually got asked to perform at, we had a Southern Association accreditation committee come in, and I was asked by the music faculty if I would perform. I was the only one in the string department who was asked to perform as a sophomore. It was good stuff. Mm-hmm. And it was all through my teacher's encouragement and just nurturing. And I love her to this day. Her name is Dr. Rochelle Vetter Huang. I will say that name every opportunity I get because I love her that much.
Yeah. Well, this is the biggest difference between a trumpet player and a violin player, okay? So, number one, trumpet players never make mistakes.
Never.
We always play the right notes.
Always.
We go for it.
They only have three valves to do.
Right, yeah. And, you know, even if it's an unplanned event, that's fine, okay? As long as you go for it and you give it everything that you have. So it's always interesting to hear about some of these issues that y'all have that I don't know why it's a problem. Anyway, all right, but we won't get into that. There's another kind of big symbol that in the book that came across for me. I'll try to do my best to explain this.
Okay.
So from what I understand, it's the great-great-grandfather of Grandma in the book.
Wait a minute. I think there's one great too many. No.
Oh, is that?
It's the great-great-grandfather of Ray, who is Grandma Nora's grandfather.
How about that? Okay. See, my math was wrong because I'm sitting there thinking the great-great.
If you ask me to say that again, okay, I'm going to get up and walk out.
but as the story goes... he received a violin as a free slave. Mm-hmm. That violin pretty much went and kind of hung out. It ended up in grandma's attic. Mm-hmm. And one day she brings it down. No one really knows what it's worth, but essentially when it's cleaned up, the news comes out, and this is where the family kind of flips out saying, hey, we got this $10 million house. Then as the family, the descendants of the slave owner finds out about this, they want their violin, the family wants their violin back. Essentially goes after, you know, Ray and the family and this whole violin, and this whole dynamic is created. And like, I couldn't help but to think the violin was given to be played at some point.
Yes.
And there was some foresight, some intentionality of giving that violin to a free slave, even at the time not knowing what this would be worth, you know, 100 or so years later. Mm-hmm. And I also think about my own parents' story. My father, who grew up in the early 40s in Jackson, Mississippi, very similar story. Saxophone stolen from a house. Ooh. That his aunt cleaned, but the aunt saw that saxophone sitting in the closet or something for years and mm-hmm. figured nobody was playing it. So I guess it's okay, right?
Sure.
All right.
Yeah.
And my mom grew up on the south side of Chicago in the mid-50s. And it was made very, very clear to them that they weren't welcome. Enough people would tell them, you are not welcome, essentially. You're not welcome in this room. Mm-hmm. And then as I remember growing up in the, you know, late 90s and 2000s, I won't say much more than that, but people saying, why aren't you people of color, black people, why aren't you in the room? So I went through a program of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra called their Talent Development Program. They sponsored 25 black and Latinx youth, paid for weekly lessons, paid for summer camps, instrument upgrades, because that was their response. Why aren't you in the room? Mm-hmm. And now that the conversations have shifted in our field and people are looking through more of an equitable lens, mm-hmm. some people are saying, essentially pushing back, kind of like the Marx family, that finally figure out the value of this, and despite everything that slavery did and everything that this violin essentially is doing for this young man, the family is just like, you know, now that you're in the room, mm-hmm. I want to take this thing back. And constantly thinking about when more equity is present, mm-hmm. the challenges, although there is a lot of people that are for it, but there's still enough power that's against it. And I was just really curious to kind of ask you, you know, your thoughts about this subject, knowing that you are a little bit older than I am. And I will say that the support that I received mm-hmm. Is a little different than the support that you received. But now that we are both on this other end, mm-hmm. Making careers as, you know, professional classical musicians, doing lots of education work and things like that. We had a moment backstage of talking about even some of the barriers that are still there and even some of the doors that have been closed even tighter.
Right.
So I'm just really curious to get your perspective about that topic.
Well, I think you said it really well. Your experience growing up was vastly different than mine. You were fortunate to get the lessons, to get the opportunities. Everything that I got was, I had to, you know, scratch and scrimp. And my first violin that my dad rented for me, you know, we couldn't afford to make the payments on it. So 7 months later, it had to go back to the music store. So I'm without an instrument for a month. And that happened probably twice a year. But somehow I managed to keep going because there were people that I don't know if it was, you know, I'm not sure what was going on in their heads, but I am grateful that they had the wherewithal to say, okay, this is a deserving kid. Let's go ahead and try to push for this. What you're referring to as far as people pushing back with the whole equity issue, I think it's very true. I think it's very sad. I think maybe sometimes people see that their positions of authority get threatened. You know, well, you don't need this. You've got basketball. You've got hip hop. You've got football. You've got the. I mean, it sounds ridiculous, but you know, and to these people, that makes a lot of sense. They feel as if they're doing you a favor. This is going to be way too difficult for you. You can't do this. You're not going to be able to handle this. This is not something that you want to do. I'm helping you out. I'm helping you. No, really, take my advice and try something else. I'm sure you've probably run into some situations like that, and they honestly think that they're doing you a favor. And that's the sad truth about it, because they don't think that you're capable. They don't think that you're good enough to be able to do it. They don't believe that you have the capacity to fully embrace what it is that you're trying to get into, which is sad. And that just makes us have to work that much harder. I don't think those types of people are ever going to go away, to be honest. I think every opportunity that they get to show how much they want to help you by, let me steer you away from this, let me give you an opportunity to do something easier that you're going to be successful at. You won't have to work as hard at this. I'm helping you. It's a sad reality that we're in, and I don't think it's going away anytime soon, but I do think that the conversation has at least started to where people are beginning to realize, wow, you're just like everybody else. You can do this. Why can't you do this? You just need the opportunity. You need to be one of those people in the room. Now that you're in the room, what can we do for you?
Yeah, I think about this quite often when, you know, we started Play on Philly, and it was, mm-hmm. you know, I want...
It's a fantastic kids. Organization.
Oh, thanks. But, you know, I want kids in the room for 2 or 3 hours every single day after school. Mm-hmm. Good teachers, quality instruments in their hands that we can loan them so they don't have to go out and rent them or buy them. You know, bringing programs to the school, mm-hmm. not to say, hey, come to my living room and have a lesson or come downtown, but to take all of those resources out and to have heard a lot, especially in our early years, mm-hmm. It's a little bit too much.
Wow.
Sometimes the funders would rather see a 1 week musical workshop given, mm-hmm. They're happy to fund literally paint buckets from Lowe's and some drumsticks to have the kids do rhythm exercises. And, you know, sometimes those have been, you know, really, really big challenges of mm-hmm. saying, you know, we can do significantly more.
Right.
And I remember early on after going to a place like the Curtis Institute of Music, where there's not a penny spared to make sure that we have the support so that we can stay focused and practice. And the significant kind of human and financial resources that go into just 150 or 160 or so students.
Right.
So, you know, I just had this thing of like, there has to be another way to do this and other allies that we can slowly find over time.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think that's going to be, you know, a really, really big challenge moving forward. And how do we make sure that there's just greater representation? When we think about even the Philadelphia Orchestra recently recording Florence Price's, mm-hmm. You know, symphonic works, and to even think about how much time it has taken
right.
to kind of rediscover her music and have everybody else kind of benefit mm-hmm. From that as well. So perhaps it won't sell as well as Beethoven Ninth Symphony.
Not yet.
Yeah, not yet.
Yeah.
But we got to get to that point.
Exactly.
And it certainly means a lot when someone like, for example, Yannick Nézet-Séguin gets mm-hmm. up and says, this is the best music ever written that was ignored so much.
Right.
And perhaps instead of playing the same melodies in Dvorak's New World Symphony, we could, you know, literally play Florence Price's music mm-hmm. That certainly incorporated the same types of...
Right.
You know, music and backgrounds of people of African descent mm-hmm. in this country. We could talk about this for another hour.
Rob. We really could. I'm sorry. Sorry, you guys. We're talking a little shop over here.
But I do want to bring, you know, one more thing up. And it's something I heard a lot from my own father of, you know, let what comes out of the bell speak for itself. Hmm. And he always had this attitude and kind of insists that, you know, I practice a bunch, I keep my mouth shut because probably he knew my own temperament because it's very much like his. But, you know, like Ray, who could always find ways to really stay focused and centered musically, kind of despite all of the deafening chaos and noise in his life, I kind of have three questions that could be melted into one, okay? So it's in a kind of a three-part series of, you know, how have you stayed on that kind of windy and narrow road? What advice would you have for me? What advice would you have for the young, aspiring classical musicians being nurtured in programs like Play On Philly? And then how might the world of classical music support the next generation of aspiring professional classical musicians of color?
Those are fantastic questions. Absolutely fantastic. Let's start with the first one. Give it to me again.
So how have you stayed on that path over the years?
I think for me, it's because I absolutely love it. It's just something that is just inherent within me. And when you love something, you attack it full on, head on, regardless. If it's a part of you and you love it, you go with it. And nothing can deter you from that. And also having people who support you definitely helps. In the book, in Ray's case, he would always go back to his grandmother. He would always go back to what it was that she said to him. You know, she told him to, well, I won't tell, you can read it and it's going to be amazing. And you're like, oh, so his grandmother was really sweet. So just staying focused, doing what it is that you love. I absolutely loved music. I love music to this day. It has done so much for me. I feel like I owe music as opposed to music helping me. I owe this music. This is what I owe to you, music, because you've done so much for me. And when I say you've done so much for me, I literally would have been in prison or dead were it not for music. My violin took me around the world. It took me to college, kept me out of trouble. You know, it showed me how to focus. It showed me what hard work was, and it showed me what hard work could do for you. So just keeping that focus. I was doing it as much for the music as the music was doing for me. It was basically a trade-off. Second thing.
What advice do you have for me? What advice do you have for young people that are starting on that journey that have heard Mozart 40 and they're super inspired, they want to make this their life, they're consumed by it? What advice would you have for us?
Stay true to who you are. Stay true to who you are. If your friends like basketball and you don't like basketball, it's okay. If your friends like hip hop and you're not such a hip hop head, that's okay too. Do what it is that you love and stay true to yourself. Put in the work. The work will pay off. It absolutely will pay off. And if it's not worth working for, it's not worth doing.
And the last one, how might the world of classical music, those that want to be allies to seeing a more equitable, perhaps a more diverse, a more inclusive, maybe a space where people from different cultural backgrounds can belong, or how might these allies engage differently?
Personally, I think that people should be open to giving people new experiences. It's not for a specific type of person. It's not, you don't have to have a certain zip code to be able to benefit from this. You don't have to live in a certain area. You don't have to have a certain amount of money in your bank account to benefit or to be good at it. We should stop looking at people as, oh, well, this is a young white kid who can do this, or an Asian kid who's supposed to be good at this, or a black kid who's only good at this. They're kids. They're people who love music. If you love music, you love music. Music is one of the only things in this universe that you can go across the world, not speak the language, and you can play music and you'll have an automatic connection. It should be a crime to deny anyone that. That should not be denied anyone, regardless of where you live, where you're from, who you know. It doesn't matter. It's for everybody. And I think if we start looking at it that way, oh, it's classical music. It's not just for, you know, little blonde-haired, blue-eyed Susie. This is for Raekwon over here, too. He can do it just as well. Give him the opportunity.
So
how was that? Y'all like that?
No. So Last question before we open it up to the audience. From what I understand, there is a microphone that will float to you. So if you wouldn't mind waiting till the microphone arrives so that, again, our online audience and those that will consume this later can hear your voice. But you said you got a 2-book deal, so I guess there's a second book coming.
Yeah.
I have an idea for you.
Oh. Okay. I'm write this down. Hang on.
About a trumpeter.
Oh.
Maybe.
Yeah. Hey, okay. Is it a trumpeter who knows Ray Chin?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
And this could be, and you know, that trumpeter's name could, you know, be Stan.
Stan.
That's a good, something like that. Yeah. So I was just want to put that one out there, but can you tell us about what you might be thinking about for your second book?
See, I just wrote down Stan Trumpeter.
How about that?
I got you in book three.
Book three.
Yeah, wow. My second book is I finished the manuscript and it's being edited right now, and I'm getting it back and working on some revisions. Actually, all next week, I'm just going to sequester myself and just make some changes and really good edits. I'm in love with this story. It's about a young musicologist and a computer linguist who discover that America's most popular composer, this guy, you think Beethoven has nothing on this guy. Everybody in the world knows his name, all of his music. He has done music for theater, for symphonies, for opera, for film, just everything. He's done it all. His name is synonymous with music. Best composer in the world. His 150th anniversary of his birth is coming up, and this grand celebration is coming along. And this, there is a lost score. He had written a 5-opera cycle, much like Wagner's Ring cycle, but it was about the Olympic rings, the rings of Olympia. And it's discovered that the final opera, Red, which is the opera of the Americas, has actually been lost. And he tried to recreate it, and it was a flop. Come to find out, he may not have written any of this music. It was appropriated from a black woman who, we would say today, lives with autism. And there's some appropriation and some, you know, well, taking advantage of, and it's a beautiful story, and it's I'm so excited about it, and the characters are fantastic, and I'm really, really happy to incorporate someone who is living with autism in as one of the main characters. And it's going, I'm telling you, you're gonna love it. You're gonna love it. I love it. You're gonna love it.
So maybe Stanita?
Okay, I'm telling you, book three, right, book three.
All right. So anyway, we would like to turn it over to you if you all have any questions.
Hi, good evening. So I have a question. Are there any, this question is for you, the author. Are there any African American composers that one should know of? Because as I think about music and think about how I share music and the history of music from a very minimal standpoint, I've never thought of including African American composers or classical music. It just wasn't a genre that I would even associate. Mm-hmm. And so I just, I had put this little presentation together of music, and I did not include anything classical. So should I, are they in the same circles, or who would have inspired you as a classical musician?
Wow, that is a great question. I applaud you for putting together this program for classical music, and Stanford can probably give you just as many names as I can. He mentioned Florence Price, who's a fantastic composer. Not only she's a black person, a woman too, a black woman, so that's awesome, Florence Price. And my personal favorite, William Grant Still. William Grant Still, I mean, he is, in my opinion, one of the most underrated composers out there. His music is phenomenal. It is absolutely phenomenal. If you really want a couple of pieces, his first symphony is gorgeous. His suite for violin and piano, it's one of the most difficult things I've ever played. It's also one of the most rewarding things I've ever played. He pours his soul into this piece, and it's just, I mean, I get chills just thinking about it now. And I played that for a competition, and I won. You know, I didn't win, but I rocked that piece. I destroyed it. a lot of William Grant Still's music, he draws on African roots, and it's just, I mean, I wouldn't consider it black classical music. To me, it's just classical music, happened to be written by a black man. Let's throw some more names out.
Oh, gosh. I think about Duke Ellington.
Oh, yeah.
In addition. But wrote a couple of suites for orchestra that I really enjoy, William Dawson.
Mm-hmm.
Wynton Marsalis, jazz trumpeter, as we all know, but had a very long career as a classical trumpeter.
Yeah. And I believe very good classical composer as well. As he does some really good stuff. Yes.
And I believe one of maybe the only people that in the same year won a Grammy both in classical and jazz.
Mm-hmm.
Wynton's writing really, really great stuff. I think about Gabriella Lena Frank, who's writing really, really great music, Jesse Montgomery.
Mm-hmm.
As well, so there's a good amount, and I will even say that I will be on a lifelong journey of learning about more composers and introducing, you know, that music to especially a lot of the kids that I work with.
And may I just say, when you do these presentations, I personally wouldn't say, okay, here's Beethoven and here's a black composer. They're all composers. It's all music. It's not, okay, this is, they happen to draw upon the music from the black experience. That's all it is. Beethoven drew upon the music of the German experience. That's what it was. It's the same thing. It's all music. He just happens to be a black guy who wrote some fantastic music. He's a composer. He's right up there with the greats.
That's really a comment as much as a question. I think it's a good idea not even to call it classical music. Just talk about music. Because people have a immediate turnoff by the word classical. And yet when you play the great music of anyone, whether it's from, you know, from William Grant Still or a composer of today, it's just music. And whether it's Wynton Marsalis doing jazz or doing classical. So, and I would think, Stan, that you probably know some young black composers that are up and coming. And that's exciting, too, for young people to see that it's part of your life. My question basically is, how do you make, and I'm using the term classical again, but how do we make the music that we love and that we're passionate about more part of the world around us? Not even just any one group, but the masses out there. How can we make it more, since we're so passionate about it and it's meant so much to our lives, how can we bring it out to the world more than it has been?
You want to go first?
Yeah, I mean, I'll start. I mean, in terms of, I think that there's so many opportunities to incorporate the music that we love, world's music, into kind of more mainstream media. Mm-hmm. So I love the music of Bridgerton. I don't know why I got into it, but anyway, I got into it. And what was really interesting for those that watched the series is to hear how this world's music was integrated. Everything from popular music played on more traditional symphonic classical instruments, all the way to, you know, I mean, music that, you know, from Brahms and others that appeared in it. And by the time I finished the series, I actually had a really, really great experience just, you know, hearing all of the music kind of melt together. And I know a lot of people that experienced Bridgerton also had a very similar experience, that it doesn't have to be so stuffy. So I think a lot more work can be done, more collaborative projects with especially different art forms, collaborative projects with different communities, members of the communities, organizations, those types of things. And I fundamentally believe in leaving our traditional concert halls. It would be great not to renovate, do another $80 million renovation of something, and actually kind of flip the script in a way of what would it look like if every Philadelphia Orchestra performance was done in different venues throughout the city, and what if my kids had more access to playing at the Kimmel Center? What if more local churches with choirs had a chance to go sing in the Kimmel Center, in a way saying, let's make this change. Let's, give you the Kimmel Center for a year in exchange for you giving the Philadelphia Orchestra or the Chamber Music Society, however you want to say, a different venue. So I think that there are lots of opportunities. And then imagine if that attitude was taken by every orchestra across the country, the type of change 10 years from now, all of the people introduced to the world's music in new and exciting ways.
I think that is absolutely fantastic. I think it's just about exposure. If you were exposed to this, I was blessed to be able to hear that symphony. You know, she just happened to play it. You know, I was there that day. I'm going to play a little bit of classical music. I'd never heard anything like that before, you know, and I don't know that my classmates had either. I always try to incorporate classical music in everything that I do. I am not the stereotypical classical musician. Stanford is not the stereotypical classical musician. You know, when I walk into an elementary classroom, I walk into my elementary school and the kids are there and I see the sea of faces. They think, you know, I'm one of the cleaning people. And it's like, no, I'm your teacher and I'm going to play the violin. How do you know how to do that? Because when I was your age, someone did exactly for me what I'm about to do for you. And I think it's all about exposure. We have this, for some reason, we have this impression that you're supposed to do this. You're supposed to like this type of music. This is what you gravitate towards. For the longest time, and you can probably speak to this, for the longest time, people tried to get me to gravitate towards jazz. Because that's what I was supposed to be doing. Well, why don't you play the trumpet? No, you play drums. No, you play saxophone. No, I play the violin. Well, why do you do that? Because I love it. Well, how did you get into that? How did you get into whatever it is that you're doing? It's the same thing. It's all about exposure. I love the idea of you know, not everyone, not the Philadelphia Symphony doing the same program at the same place every, spread the joy, spread it around. There are people, I guarantee, that if they had an opportunity to be exposed to this stuff, it would change their life. And 10 years, I don't even think it would take 10 years. I think it would take a lot less time than that if that were the attitude that people had. And that's a fantastic question. And I applaud you because I know you're going to go out and probably try to do something about it. It took one time for me to see a violin. Yep, that's what I want. That's all it took. Yeah.
And then also to have the opportunity to play it.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah,
play
yeah.
it with other people. And I think that's one thing we don't see enough of in our schools. And I mean, Philadelphia, yeah, there are music programs in the vast majority of schools, but I do still think there's a difference between holding violins and trumpets and trombones and having that opportunity to make sound and make that sound with mm-hmm. your friends. And sometimes even when I look at some of my colleagues, it's like, yeah, there's a reason why people don't know how hard it is to make a great instrument, you know, like in the story, sounds so good. And, you know, I think that goes with anything in life. It's so much easier to appreciate once you know how hard it is to put the ball in the basket.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Or throw that football across the field mm-hmm. for 80 yards and have the timing, the perfect timing of that receiver catching it. I think we all understand how hard that is. But I just think if more people understood how hard it was to make that violin sound good, they would say things like, yeah, I think the musicians of the Philly Orchestra each be paid $500,000 a year because to get up and play a Strauss yep. tone poem
oh, yeah.
Night after night, three nights in a row and get those notes. Yep. I mean, that's...
It's work.
You know, we studied that all the time
yep.
and it's not easy to do that. So those are, you know, but of course I know how hard that is. So we might have, I think, time for one more question.
So my question actually stems from you as an author. So transitioning from music to actually writing about it or a story based around it, what was that experience like and what advice might you give to anyone that is looking to write a book of their own, whether it's now or in the future, and some of the challenges maybe you went through and some of the tools you might have used to get better and better at it?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. Some of the best advice that I was actually given was write what you know and write honestly, because if you don't believe it, how can you expect anyone else to believe it? You know, take yourself seriously. If this is what you want to do, you do it. There are going to be obstacles. There will always be obstacles, but it's just like with everything else. If as a musician, you know, you have this one piece of music that's giving you a ton of trouble. You can't give up on it. You don't quit. You work hard at it. You dissect it. You go slowly. You get advice from other people. Listen to this. Tell me what you think. Constantly. Constant edits in books. You know, I'm always, hey, can I read this for you? Tell me what you think about this. Does this make sense to you? You can't be afraid to get other people's opinions. That doesn't mean that you have to necessarily take the advice or agree with the opinion, but it's nice to hear it. There's always going to be people that don't like what it is that you do, and that's okay. Opinions are like elbows. Everybody's got one or two. It's okay. Write what you know. Write honestly. Write often. Does that help? All right. Do it. I mean, if you believe in it, if you truly believe in it. A friend of mine told me when I was in college, Brendan, you told me that you were going to write a story about your life. You did, and I can't believe that you actually did it. I'm like, well, I told you I was going to do it. You know, we practice all day long. I would do 3.5 hours every day, 3.5 hours every day practicing my violin every single day, regardless of how I felt, regardless of how I felt I was progressing or not progressing. It's the same thing with the writing. I sat down, I'm like, I'm going to do this today. Do I feel like writing? No. Would I rather be outside? Yes. Do I want to read a comic book instead? Absolutely. It's 9:00. This movie is coming on that I really wanted to see. Would I rather do that? Yes, but I am committed to doing this, and I know that the hard work is going to pay off.
But well, this is great. Well, I'm not writing a book because Brendan's going to write it for me. So that's going to work out.
And the trumpet player's name is going to be Stan.
Right. Look, I really, really enjoyed this conversation. I enjoyed the book more. But no.
I think that's the compliment. No.
But enjoyed this conversation and enjoyed the book, and it was just really, really great to see myself and a lot of other people that have pursued classical music that look like us mm-hmm. portrayed in these stories. And as difficult as some of them are, I think to be able to find the truths of those experiences. So I just really want to thank you for sharing so much of yourself in this book and really in Ray's character. With that said, give Brendan, please, a round of applause.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.